You're listening to the Body Pros CME and CE podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. This is part of a podcast series summarizing key HIV research from CROI 2008. To listen to the rest of this series, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of The Body Pro. I'm here in Boston at CROI 2008 with Dr. David Wall, a clinician researcher who is an associate professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director of HIV services for the North Carolina Department of Corrections. Dr. Wall will provide a clinically focused summary of breaking research from CROI 2008 on HIV-related complications, including a look at cardiovascular and metabolic problems.
There are a lot of conferences now that are dedicated to specific issues within HIV, including metabolic complications. So some of the metabolic stuff, I think, gets diluted a little bit across the different conferences. So it's not too surprising that we don't have any earth-shattering data regarding metabolic complications here, especially about body shape changes. There are some important data that I'll mention in a little bit about cardiovascular disease risk that I think were really one of the top stories of this conference. I'm going to start with body shape change and talk a little bit about a study that was looking at growth hormone. And before you roll your eyes, oh yes, just another growth hormone study, this one's a little bit different. I think this is kind of the way that maybe growth hormone studies should have been done, and that some people who really knew a lot about this were advocating for it to be done, but just didn't happen. And specifically what I'm talking about is a very nice study presented by Steve Grinspoon, where he used growth hormone, but he didn't use it in the really high doses that have been explored in previous studies among HIV-infected patients. He used physiologic doses, and Steve is a really smart endocrinologist, and endocrinologists like to use hormones in doses that replicate normal cycles that occur in the body. And so Steve did what I think he's been dreaming of doing for a long time and used low doses of growth hormone. We're talking about 2 to 6 micrograms per kilogram per day. So these are the kind of doses of growth hormone that are given to people who are deficient in growth hormone to replicate and mimic what would be a natural growth hormone level in the body. And so what he did was an 18-month double-blind placebo-controlled study of this strategy, first screening people to see whether or not they had some evidence of growth hormone deficiency and using a sophisticated test called the growth hormone arginine stimulation test that endocrinologists who know what they're doing can use. And he then was able to select people who really could benefit from growth hormone replacement and study them over time. So really interesting design, a little bit different than what we've seen before. Subjects were adults. They had to be HIV infected and on stable antiretroviral therapy. To get in the study, you had to have a waist-to-hip ratio that was 0.9 for men and 0.85 for women or greater, and those are pretty standard. And you had to have evidence also of increased abdominal girth or loss of fat in the extremities or a loss of fat in the face. And again, growth hormone response given the arginine testing had to be low. There are exclusion criteria, and there are mostly just those that make sense, including diabetes. Growth hormone can make diabetes worse, and you couldn't be pregnant or have carpal tunnel syndrome. Carpal tunnel syndrome also could be aggravated by this hormone. There were 65 patients who were randomized, 72 to growth hormone and 29 to placebo in this randomization strategy. At the end of the day, 21 completed the protocol in the growth hormone arm versus 27 in the placebo arm. So again, a not very large study, but still an important one. What occurred during the course of the study when assessing body shape using imaging techniques, we see that over the time period of 18 months, in the placebo arm, there was no change in visceral adiposity. However, among those who received growth hormone at low doses that were described before, we do see a decrease over time, and it ended up being approximately about 9% decrease in visceral adiposity over the course of the study. In addition, there were not major changes in extremity fat, and that has been a concern because growth hormone is lipolytic, meaning it can lyse adipocytes. So it doesn't care if the adipocyte is located in the visceral abdomen or the face or the arms. And at low doses, we didn't see much of a problem with growth hormone wasting fat in the periphery. Lean mass did seem to increase a little bit and significantly, and that's a positive thing because lean body mass improvements have been associated with improved health. As far as lipid profiles, this was not a concern with growth hormone in this study at these low doses. Triglycerides actually decreased in people who got on the growth hormone compared to those who received the placebo, where we saw basically no change in triglycerides. No effects were seen on other lipoprotein profiles. Carotid intimal thickness was done, and there was not really any change seen with growth hormone despite the lipid changes that I talked about previously. And one explanation for that may be that despite using physiologic or near physiologic growth hormone, glucose tolerance did worsen with growth hormone. This was a surprising finding because if we really are replicating physiologic doses of growth hormone, one wouldn't expect that there'd be a problem with glucose tolerance, but there was a significant difference in glucose tolerance over the course of the study, with those getting the growth hormone having worse glucose tolerance and those who are on placebo having no change. And this may have something to do with the administration of growth hormone. It's not being secreted in little amounts over a period of time and in cycles, and the administration of the drug IV, or in this case subcutaneously, may have some effect on glucose levels that are poorly explained. Otherwise, adverse effects were fairly minimal. The adverse effects that have plagued this drug in other trials, including the carpal tunnel syndrome, the arthralgias, the edema, really weren't seen here. So low doses of growth hormone over a long period of time were well tolerated and led to modest decreases in visceral adiposity. Now, when you compare this to other studies of growth hormone, not surprisingly, you see more bang for the buck when you give higher doses, but you get more toxicity at the same time. So when you gave higher dose growth hormone in other studies, looking at maybe 4 milligrams per day, you see maybe 20% or more decrease in visceral adiposity. Where in this study, with much more modest doses, averaging around 0.3 milligrams per day, over a longer period of time, about 9 to 10% decrease in visceral adiposity. So there's a slower loss of visceral adipose tissue, but at the same time, what we're seeing is better tolerability. Growth hormone releasing factor, or growth hormone releasing hormone, is another compound that's under study, and this looks to be a very exciting drug. There was nothing major presented on that drug at this conference, but at previous conferences, looks very promising. It also can produce decreases in visceral adiposity approaching 15% or more, and seems to be better tolerated than higher dose growth hormone. So I think at the end of the day, whether or not we're going to be using low dose growth hormone or some alternative is still unclear. And the role for low dose growth hormone is not very certain at this point. But what I think this study points out is that we basically have been overdosing people with growth hormone in these previous studies, and that if I was forced to use growth hormone for lack of an alternative, I would probably use low dose of growth hormone as was done in this study, and I would do so for a longer period of time. It may be that another 18 months of study, beyond the 18 months that were looked at here, would produce even further gains in visceral adipose tissue. So I think that this is an option for some folks, but not something that I think most of us are going to be able to do. Of course, lower doses of growth hormone are less expensive than higher doses, and this may make it a little bit more palatable because of the expense of the drug when used at higher doses. In another study that I think also is interesting when thinking about body shape change, there was analysis done by some investigators looking at just how much loss of fat one has to experience in order to perceive that you've lost fat. In many of the studies that have been conducted of late, a 20% loss in extremity fat has been considered a significant loss. And it's justified because many people say that that's a clinical significant amount of fat loss. But there's really no data to indicate that that is a clinically significant amount of loss of fat. And that is sort of a line in the sand that has been developed somewhat arbitrarily. In this one analysis, loss of fat of the extremities by DEXA scan was correlated to perceptions of fat loss among people who had experienced some of fat loss. And what these investigators found was that it really was around 30% fat loss in the extremities that people started to notice the changes. I think that's useful, and it helps us understand what the threshold is before it becomes really clinically evident. In most of the studies that we're doing, we don't want it to get that bad. So I think using 20% fat loss still is useful in many of our clinical trials as a line to not be crossed or a line to compare across study arms, and does have some clinical utility. But it is interesting to know that when you think about patients and what they perceive, it's going to be even greater fat losses that are noticeable to them and others. So I think that was another little presentation that helped us understand a little bit more about fat loss. Lastly, in this category of body shape changes, there was an interesting poster looking at supplementation with chromium. Chromium is a micronutrient. It purportedly has activity to improve some insulin parameters, glucose metabolism parameters, maybe some other things. And it was thought that perhaps if this was given to people who have HIV infection, that it might reduce visceral adiposity, might improve some lean fat loss, and also glucose and insulin parameters. And to make a pretty short story even shorter, in a smaller study from Canada, the drug or supplement, if you will, seemed to have some activity. The poster was a little unclear about some of the measurements and the degree of decline in fat, but there seemed to be at least a trend for fat loss in the abdomen by DEXA scan. So that would look at both subcutaneous and visceral fat and not be able to distinguish the two, and seem to improve glycemic parameters as well. So this may be something worthy of future study, perhaps in a more rigorous way with larger numbers, and perhaps also with a standardized compound. There was not much mentioned about the type of chromium that was used, what quality assurance went into the use of this particular supplement. So I think intriguing, not ready for prime time, something that we could probably explore in another way. Let's look at cardiovascular issues, because there were a number of presentations at this conference that were at the very least intriguing and at the most provocative. Most provocative, and really I think the presentation that generated the most buzz here was an interesting report from the DAD cohort. This is a very interesting study. It's an interesting group of investigators. As many of you are aware, it's a meta cohort of 11 different cohorts across Europe and North America that combine their data prospectively to look at outcomes among people who have HIV infection, largely people who are under HIV therapies. In this particular analysis, they were trying to understand the risk of myocardial infarction and nucleoside therapy. This group has published quite extensively about risk for myocardial infarction and stroke amongst their cohort, a very robust cohort of over 25,000 people. And at the time of this particular analysis, 33,000 individuals had been enrolled in this particular cohort. And they published in the New England Journal recently that protease inhibitor exposure was linked to increased risk of myocardial infarction. And there had been a trend for NNRTI exposure to also lead to increased risk of MI at different time points, but not at the most recent time point. Well, what they wanted to do is also look at the nucleosides. And so they did an analysis under the hypothesis that the thymidine analogs of D4T and AZT would likely be linked to myocardial infarction. And lo and behold, what did they find? But that it was actually abacavir, and to a lesser extent DDI, that they had found linked to myocardial infarction in their cohort. Interestingly, they've done a number of different analyses to try to understand this and make sure it wasn't a mistake. And after even double-checking their numbers, the same relationship comes out. When you look at the people who did get abacavir and those who didn't, some things strike you right away. And one is that the cardiovascular risk profile of people who were not on abacavir was a little bit better than that of those on abacavir. And this may suggest something called channeling bias. That's where you channel people to a particular therapy based upon your perceptions about their risk for an adverse event or some other outcome. So in this case, you might say to someone who has cardiovascular risks, I'm going to put you on a Bacavir because I don't want to put you on D4T, and maybe I don't even want to put you on AZT. And so you would concentrate people at higher risk for cardiovascular disease in your Bacavir arm. Well, the DAD investigators totally appreciated that, and controlling for a number of different cardiovascular disease risk factors, tried to adjust for that in their analysis. And what they were able to find is that it still persisted, that even with controlling for a number of different factors, including hypertension, dyslipidemia, CHD risk predicted by the Framingham cohort, etc., what you see is that there's this persistent effect of a Bacavir being linked to the risk of myocardial infarction. And the relative risk we're talking about here is on the order of about 1.6. So what we're talking about is an increased risk that's statistically significant even after trying to control for confounders. Again, other interesting analyses were done, including exposure time, because perhaps it's use of a Bacavir that's a marker for longer-term NRTI exposure. And what they found that it wasn't cumulative or past exposure to a Bacavir that made the biggest impact. It was more recent use of a Bacavir. Furthermore, when a Bacavir was discontinued, the risk of myocardial infarction, that excess risk, dissipated, suggesting that this effect existed during treatment with the drug and went away when the drug was no longer taken. So there could be some direct toxicity, one can hypothesize, of the drug on cardiovascular disease. Stroke was not increased in this particular analysis. It was only myocardial infarction. And a cumulative effect doesn't seem to be likely. DDI, as I mentioned earlier, also had an effect, but it was much more modest. So this really generated, as you can imagine, a lot of concern. A Bacavir is now becoming increasingly popular. We now have methods for determining who's at risk for developing a hypersensitivity reaction, and that test has opened up a new venue for a Bacavir where it didn't have one before. Furthermore, the Department of Health and Human Services has upgraded a Bacavir and 3TC to a preferred NNRTI status. So what does this all mean? Well, I think it's important to recognize a few things. One, this is a cohort study. This is not a randomized clinical trial. And the DAD investigators even did an unusual thing by issuing a statement, almost like a press release, along with their poster, indicating that we should be very cautious about interpreting these data. And I think that was very wise of them. Cohort data are not the same thing as a clinical trial. A rigorous clinical trial can maybe help tease this out much better than a cohort study, which inherently has to be subjected to increased bias compared to a randomized study that tries to negate such bias. I also think that there's no underlying mechanism that's been really postulated yet, so we have to be very cautious about interpreting exactly what's going on here. Certainly others will go into their databases and look at a Bacavir exposure and myocardial infarction, other cardiovascular disease risks. Problem is, there's probably not too many cohorts that have the power that this one does with as many outcomes. In this case, over 500 individuals had had MIs and 33,000 individuals in their cohort. One thing that I think also has to be explored, are there any other confounders that were not corrected for? You can try to adjust for as many of these confounders as possible, but you can't get all of them, and it's just the ones you think are most likely to be operative. So could there be other things that are going on? Was there a preferential statin use in those not on a Bacavir? Were there more hypertension medicines used in those not on a Bacavir? These are things that I think have to be teased out, but this is the start of, an investigation that's going to need to be done, and hopefully we'll have a better sense of this not too long from now. Importantly in the study, the risk was pretty low for those who had minimal cardiovascular disease risk factors at all. So being on a Bacavir slightly increased the risk of having an MI, but the relative risk, while there, was nothing like the absolute risk. The absolute risk remained fairly low. It's those people who did have high risk of cardiovascular disease based upon the Framingham calculation that seemed to have the biggest impact of having a Bacavir added on. So I think at this point, this is very exploratory. I'm not sure what most people are going to do with it. I think for me, if I were to look at a patient who had significant cardiovascular risks and I could choose between abacavir and, let's say, tenofovir or another drug, I might go with the non-abacavir nucleoside in those who had higher risk cardiovascular disease. Now, I say tenofovir. Tenofovir wasn't looked at in this study. There aren't enough people yet in their analysis database on tenofovir to explore this. They think that it'll take about another year. That also gives you a sense of sort of the data that are in the DAD that are being evaluated. Clearly, there's some lag time given that they don't have enough people on tenofovir just yet. So again, this is all working in the dark and with minimal information, but my bottom line would be this is not going to impact my practice all that much, may give me second thoughts among my patients who are smokers with dyslipidemia and who have hypertension and such. But clearly a very, very interesting and provocative study that unfortunately was a poster and not an oral presentation, but in many ways, I think, generated more buzz than most of the oral presentations at this conference. Another story here at CROI focused on inflammation. We know that HIV can cause inflammation, and in the SMART study, one of the leading hypotheses about why people did so poorly when they stopped their therapy was that when you stop HIV therapy, the virus shoots up, and you get inflammatory chemicals that are coursing through the body that cause all sorts of badness. And that has not really been documented. We certainly know that as people progress with their HIV infection and even develop AIDS, there are a number of cytokines and lymphokines that increase, TNF-alpha, for instance. But what we wanted to find out from SMART is whether or not when people stop therapy, was there this release of cytokines and lymphokines that are known to be pro-inflammatory, and which ones were at work at this time point? So today there was a very nice discussion of this from the SMART investigators looking at what happened when people stopped their HIV therapy. Specifically, the investigators looked at a number of different markers of inflammation and coagulation. As far as coagulation, D-dimer was looked at. It's a marker of thrombosis. And in inflammatory reactions, C-reactive protein, IL-6, amyloid A, and serum amyloid P were also evaluated. What was obvious was that even before people stopped their HIV therapy across the cohort, there already was evidence of increased inflammation going on at baseline. Specifically, IL-6 and D-dimer levels were elevated. What you see, though, is that once people stop their HIV therapy, the viral load goes up and D-dimer also goes up. And D-dimer outside of HIV has been linked to cardiovascular disease, such that increases might double at the most or a little bit more than double your risk for cardiovascular disease. In this particular study, we saw fantastic increases in D-dimer levels as HIV levels climbed, such that those who had greater than 50,000 increases in their HIV viral load level by 1 month saw close to a 28-fold increase in their D-dimer level. So off the charts when you're looking at this, comparing it to people who are not HIV infected, indicating that these people are at increased risk for thrombosis-related events, including cardiovascular disease. In addition, when the inflammatory markers were looked at, similarly, inflammatory marker like IL-6 did increase after cessation of HIV therapy. Importantly, when you look at IL-6, it was closely linked to mortality, well beyond and above viral load or CD4 cell count. There was a very strong and robust link to mortality with this particular inflammatory cytokine. I think these data do help close the loop on our understanding of what happened when people stopped their HIV therapy. Clearly, there are people who died in this discontinuation therapy arm, but not of cardiovascular disease, and I think we have to understand more about the linkage between inflammation and some of these other conditions. At this time, I think it's very clear, though, stopping your therapy increases inflammation in your body, and that can't be a good thing. There were a couple of posters here looking at pro-inflammatory markers and correlates with intimal thickness of the carotid that did indicate that there was a correlation there. Other studies have not found the same thing, so there's some discrepancies there. But I think the well-controlled studies and the studies that present here were fairly impressive. In addition, there was one study of only 9 patients where pentoxyphylline, a drug that's used oftentimes for claudication of the legs, that particular compound was also found to reduce inflammatory markers and improve endothelial function when given to patients with HIV infection. This might be another thing to explore to try to reverse some of the inflammation that occurs during HIV infection, even in people who have fairly well-controlled HIV, as was seen in this study. So I think that this is an emerging picture. Importantly, on the heels of the results from SMART, there were other data provided by investigators from the STACCATO study. This is another treatment interruption study. The analysis that was presented was restricted to 145 individuals who were started on HIV therapy in Thailand. So you have to think very hard about the setting in which the study was done, as it differs tremendously from studies that would be done, let's say, here in the United States, in that we're dealing with a population that has a lower BMI and lower cardiovascular disease at baseline. In fact, in this study, there really weren't too many inflammatory markers that were elevated in patients at baseline or during their therapy. What they did see, however, though, was that once you stopped HIV therapy during a strategic treatment interruption, and pro-inflammatory cytokines did change such that they increased, and endothelial function markers also worsened when people were off of therapy. Importantly, when people went back on therapy, much like we saw with the SMART study, there was residual damage. And so the cytokine levels improved somewhat when you restarted your HIV therapy, but did not come back to the baseline levels, such as those achieved when viremia was under control. So what I think this means is that there are these pro-inflammatory markers. There is this inflammatory state. HIV therapy reduces this by reducing antigenemia, by reducing the viral load, and that when you stop this, you get this burst of inflammation, and this burst of inflammation is not like something you can turn on and off. And even when you start back on HIV therapy, some damage has been done, some residual inflammation continues, maybe because of some continued antigenic stimulation that we're not measuring, or because there's a cascade that's been unleashed and it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle. I think more work has to be done. This is still very preliminary. We don't have many opportunities to look at people on and off HIV therapy, and fewer opportunities in the future given that treatment trials that involve interruptions are pretty much, you know, a non-starter. But I think there's an evolving story here regarding the link between HIV, HIV therapy, and inflammation that we're going to all hear a lot about from here on in. Another important theme from this conference dealt with mortality and aging. It's clear that the HIV-infected population is getting older and that there are diseases, such as the cardiovascular diseases we've mentioned, that are becoming more and more important to the population and more of a concern for the clinicians who are caring for individuals who are infected with HIV. So I think that it's only proper that we start thinking about the long term, about people who have HIV infection living into their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. There have been a number of analyses now that show us that HIV-infected people can expect to live as long as 3 decades after their diagnosis, and that's assuming that there's no major advances in HIV therapy from now until then. So I think it's not inconceivable that the majority of people who are living with HIV infection and doing well may well succumb to something other than their HIV infection itself. That's not to say that everyone's off the hook, and it's clear that there could be relationships between having HIV and risk for non-HIV-related events. A number of the cohort studies we've mentioned have already found links between immunosuppression and diseases that are not classically considered to be HIV-related, including some malignancies that we don't think about as being necessarily related to immunosuppression, i.e. lung cancer. lung cancer is increasing among people with HIV infection. That's a consequence of some lifestyle issues such as smoking, but also it's likely that there is an immune component to the control of malignancies that people with HIV infection are more likely to develop. I think that's a consequence of the immune suppression that they may have experienced either in the past or relatively even presently. So a CD4 cell count of 400 is great, but it's not an 800 or a 1200 CD4 cell count. And does long-term exposure to a CD4 cell count of 400 put you at risk for diseases that can be kept at bay with a higher CD4 cell count? So I think that's an important part of the research going on in the realm of HIV. And here we saw several different studies that have tried to look at that. One of the most important studies, however, that I think has been presented here at this conference involves not so much what happens to people as they enjoy the benefits of HIV therapy and live to the golden years. The study that I'm talking about looked at what happens when people present with opportunistic infections. These are people who come in either knowing they have HIV infection but not dealing with it, or more likely, not knowing they're HIV infected and come in with a devastating opportunistic condition. So PCP, cryptococcal meningitis, disseminated MAC and such, these are things that we are continuing to see. A major concern is in such people who come in with one of these opportunistic infections who are not on HIV therapy, when's the right time to start HIV therapy? Should we start HIV therapy in the hospital while that person is getting treated for their opportunistic infection? Or should we wait? Most providers that I know like to wait. Treat the opportunistic infection, get them out of the hospital, have them come back to the clinic, and then start their HIV therapy. Well, when you talk about this with some providers, that's the way they do it. Talk to other providers and they say, no, let's start the therapy right away in the hospital. We can monitor the side effects. We could work out drug interactions, etc. So there's this equipoise between these two strategies, and that's a perfect setup for doing a clinical trial. And that's what the AIDS Clinical Trials Group did. They launched an ambitious study called A5164. And this randomized people who had opportunistic infections, specifically PCP or a serious bacterial infection such as pneumonia or sepsis or a deep-seated infection or endocarditis, cryptococcal disease, disseminated MAC or other atypical mycobacterial infections, or toxoplasmosis of the central nervous system, and lastly, CMV end organ disease. If you had any of those and you were not on HIV therapy, you were eligible for this study. And basically what happened was people were randomized to either start HIV therapy soon after the diagnosis of their opportunistic infection. The study protocol required that it had to occur within 14 days. And on average, people generally started their HIV therapy around day 12 after their diagnosis, or defer the start of HIV therapy until later on, until 28 days after enrollment into the study. The HIV regimens that were provided by the study included lopinavir-ritonavir, tenofovir, and FTC, and D4T. This was the menu from which people can choose. The study recommended that if one of those drugs were not used, that regimen could be crafted by the clinician, but that a PI that's boosted with ritonavir or an NNRTI be used along with two nucleosides. Management of HIV therapy during this trial was totally up to the clinician. Importantly, people with TB were not eligible to partake in this clinical trial. There are other studies looking at initiation of HIV therapy around the diagnosis of TB, and this study was not designed to look at that particular question. The study enrolled 282 people. It took a long time. This was a tough study to do, and it took a lot of work. It's hard to get clinicians and patients to be thinking about a study when someone comes in and they're hypoxic or they have a CNS lesion from toxoplasmosis. 141 entered the immediate treatment arm versus 141 in the deferred therapy arm. Patients were largely male. About a third were black. About another third were Hispanic. The CD4 cell count, as you'd expect, was quite low. On average, it was 29. And the viral load was high. PCP was the leading diagnosis that led to entry into the study, followed by bacterial infections or other OIs. Cryptococcus was seen in about 16 to 18% of people in this study. Toxoplasmosis less commonly. Disseminated MAC and CMV also rare, with 1 to 3% of people coming into the study with that. But interestingly, about a third of people had more than one opportunistic infection. Well, what happened during the study? Defying some of the odds makers, perhaps, what occurred was that when people started HIV therapy immediately, they had a significant decrease in their mortality or progression to AIDS. And this was very important, and it developed early on into the study. The differences between the two arms separated out quite early. The survival advantage persisted even out to 48 weeks after the study initiation. So I think what we see here is a really clear answer to a question that had really dodged us clinically. And we still continue to see this. This is not some interesting tidbit that we could look at as being a remnant from days of HIV past. I think we still see this. We still argue about this. And these data resoundingly tell us that when we see someone with an opportunistic infection, such as those that we saw here, so treatable opportunistic infections, delaying HIV therapy puts patients at risk, and that we should be aggressive in starting HIV therapy at the time of their diagnosis. Now, importantly, immune reconstitution syndrome, which is a huge concern for those who are thinking about starting therapy immediately, was not seen as being a problem in the immediate therapy arm. So there were 10 cases in the immediate therapy arm versus 13 in the deferred arm. Importantly, however, we have to recognize that PCP was a leading diagnosis here, and majority of those patients probably got prednisone, and prednisone may have had an impact on that. That's not to say we shouldn't look for immune reconstitution syndromes or not be concerned about them. We should be concerned about them, but I think that the overall benefit of starting on HIV therapy outweighs the risk of immune reconstitution being a major problem in this setting. So a very important study. This is one of the studies at this conference that I think can and will change clinical practice. So when we look at studies such as that ACTG study that help us understand how we can improve survival of our patients, I think there's other considerations too. I mentioned before that a number of studies consistently find that African Americans don't do as well as whites in clinical trials and in clinical care. There wasn't a whole lot of illumination about why that is. There's not a lot of data about adherence and African Americans versus whites, and that may be part of the explanation, but I think even that is just the tip of the iceberg. A number of different posters here basically reiterated the same point regarding these ethnic and racial differences. Importantly, there was another study that I thought was worth mentioning only because of its shocking take-home lesson. Researchers in San Francisco have been following a very interesting cohort of people who are homeless or almost near so. David Bangsberg and his group have been doing this for a number of years and generated a lot of important information, including about adherence. What they looked at in this particular study was food insecurity. That is defined as having uncertainty about where your next meal is coming from, as having an uncertain or limited availability of nutritionally adequate or safe food. So these are people who often are hungry. And what they looked for in this cohort of HIV-infected people, marginally housed, was whether or not food insecurity played a role in their virologic outcomes. And I don't think you have to guess too long or hard to figure out that yes, it did. And that's shocking. And so I think when we think about these things, it's all well and good to think about the latest inhibitor of some sort of viral mechanism, etc. When people can't even get enough food to eat, it's unlikely to make a tremendous effect. So I think that this is an important study that tells us that there are people at fantastic risk, and these are people that are being studied by this very ambitious and accomplished group of investigators, and they point to really some major concerns that we have to have regarding the care of people with HIV, and of course, care in general in our country for people who just are just at such a disadvantage. So I think that this is a very noteworthy poster in the context of all these discussions about mortality, and shouldn't be lost on those who are thinking about these things. Next, I want to talk just briefly again about aging. There were a number of different plenary sessions regarding aging, and the bottom line is that HIV accelerates the aging process. We can see this biologically, and we can see this in a number of different ways, even cognitively. And I think that the call here was for further studies to look at what exactly is this nexus between HIV and the aging process. But I think consensus was reached that this is a concern, that there's indications that people with HIV infection, even under good control of their HIV infection, may be at increased risk for conditions that occur at advanced ages. So I think a lot of research is going to go into this, including research for interventions to delay some of these aging processes. I think we're just seeing the beginning of this. And again, I expect there will be more to come, and that most conferences from now on will have some section dedicated to aging and HIV. So in summary, I think what we really are trying to concentrate on is how do we prevent disease that could be preventable? How do we prevent deaths that can be preventable? There are some deaths we can't prevent, and we're mortal. All of us are going to die, and everyone with HIV is going to die. And if they're not dying of opportunistic infections, and if they're not dying from age-related causes, well then, guess what? They're going to die from non-age-related causes. And death rates have been going down significantly among people with HIV infection. So I think what we're looking at is just trying to understand what are the preventable conditions, what can we do to optimize the chances that people could live as long as possible. That's what we do in the health field for everybody. I think that with people with HIV infection, there's these additional challenges. And understanding them better is what we heard a lot about today. And I think it's a very exciting field. We have to understand more about how we reduce cardiovascular disease risk, how we reduce malignancy risk, how we make sure people can stay mobile and not frail, make sure bone health is maintained. There were a number of different studies here showing that bones do decrease in their density during HIV infection. These are the things we have to work on and think about for the long haul. So I think we took some baby steps here. There's some good indication that this is going to be a serious concern and that that might lead to increased funding for this area of research. So I'm excited about this, and I think we're going to learn a lot over the next few years to do exactly what we want to do, which is keep people living a long time.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been part of a CME and CE podcast series summarizing key HIV research from CROI 2008. To listen to the rest of this series, as well as additional coverage of CROI 2008, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.